Hi there, I'm Cory Doctorow, and you're listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast. It's been a hell of a week. The weeks are all a hell of a week these days, because A, there's a lot of stuff going on, and B, about to move from Los Angeles back to London, and I'm freaking out about all the stuff I need to do, although it's all under control, kind of. So I went to BlizzCon this week. BlizzCon is the con for Blizzard Entertainment, the Universal Vivendi group that runs World of Warcraft, among other things. They have a reputation for being kind of authoritarian and mercenary, and for not really respecting players, but rather just sort of wanting to separate them for their money and tell them what missions they should be playing. And there was a lot of that on display here. They had weird policies about who was allowed to bring in computers and phones and bags. I mean, imagine banning computers at a conference for computer users. Just bizarre. It's like a gun show with no guns. Although that would be kind of a weird gun show. Maybe a good one. I don't know. Maybe just plastic guns. Anyway, on the other hand, there was a lot of really interesting stuff wherein the developers were really kind of listening to players. There was this weird thing where there was a group of devs sitting there, and you could line up, and you could, like, they were like tellers at a bank sitting in front of spots on a table. You could line up and you could go like, you know, I don't like this mission. Could you change this mission? And they would tell you why they wouldn't change the mission. That was actually kind of cool. The masquerade was really awesome. The weirdest thing there was a PayPal booth there, and a friend of mine walked up there and said, so I run a gold farming outfit in China. Will you launder my money for me? And they said, oh, yeah, we do tons of that. Yeah, here's my business card. Just let me know. Can you tell me who you work with in China? I want to make sure that I don't conflict with that, that it doesn't conflict with our existing business, because we might already be talking to your partners there. So that was pretty bizarre. Another totally awesome thing that happened this week, a listener named Owen Wilson heard my plea for some text editor love on Ubuntu Linux, the operating system I use. I needed help with it because the editors that I had been using lacked a couple of really important features that I use for blogging and writing, namely a word count that would actually tell me how many words there were in a selection, and something that would convert curly quotes to straight quotes and ellipsis to three dots and so on to paste material into before blogging it, so that it would just be in straight ASCII before I blogged it. And he wrote me a couple little plugins for Getit, which turns out to be a great, really flexible little text editor for Linux, so I'm very happy with it. I've actually switched back to the GNOME from KDE, if anyone out there cares, and I'm really enjoying coming back to the GNOME. KDE is flashier, but it just seems less robust and harder to actually figure out where among those millions of preferences is the one item that will fix my thing. So thank you, Owen. You are a lifesaver, and I'm loving my new editor. Speaking of editors, I wrote the Bible app for my graphic novel treatment that I talked about last week. This is the graphic novel about union organizers and Pinkertons in game space. It now has a title, courtesy of Alice Taylor from the Wonderland blog. Alice came up with a great title for it. It's called For the Win Now, FTW. Those gamers among you will understand why this makes sense. So it's off to my agent, and he's going to send it off to the umpty billion comic publishers who've been asking me if I ever want to write a comic for them, and we'll see if it goes anywhere. I'm thinking like 60 issues, although I'm told by industry insiders that it may be more likely to sign up for 24 or even 12, but we'll see what happens. I'll sure let you know what goes on from here. I also wrote a new short story last night, just a very short, 2,500 words. Well, short, anyways. I wrote it for Forbes magazine, of all places, the finance magazine. They're doing an issue on the future of work, 2027. So I wrote a story called Other People's Money about an assemblage sculptor who is turning down venture capital because they can't give her a small enough sum of money to make it worth her while. They want to give her like $1 million, and she's like, I don't need $1 million. I just need $60,000. But you, of course, can't give me $60,000 because you need to invest $1 billion, and you can't invest $1 billion in $60,000 increments. So a little kind of ironic statement about the cost of manufacturing versus the concentration of capital. So that was really interesting, gave birth to a story last night. Much more interesting and profound in my life is we got our chromosome test back, and I am the father-to-be of a little girl who will be born at the end of January. and my fiance has vetoed my first name change, which was a MySQL code injection attack, which I thought would be a great gift to give to a child. She would never be databased. We'll see what the name is. My other choice that has been turned down was Abkadefki Jukelman Awkward Stuvixes. Those of you who watch the Sesame Street show know that that's the alphabet. I thought we'd call her Abby. We could tell her she was named after Abby Hoffman. Again, not allowed. So we'll see. Whatever we name her, it'll be a good name. She's to be born at the end of January, and that's exciting as anything. Giant life changes. And this leads me to another thing, which is that in the car today, we were talking about what we might do in terms of little Abby's first computer or little code injection attack's first computer. And, or, you know, the other name I was thinking about that, that those of you who are like old school BBSers will enjoy is plus, 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 ATH, control G, control G, control G, control C, control C, control C. I thought that that would be an awesome name for Fidonet, baby. But maybe we're a few years too late for that. Anyway, so the thing that we were talking about was baby's first computer. We're like, well, and she's sort of maybe one and a half. It'll be time to get her maybe an old PC. What operating system will we run on it? Well, of course, we'll run Ubuntu on it, but we need a baby flavor of Ubuntu. Baby Ubuntu, as in buy baby Ubunting, daddy's gone a-hunting. Baby Ubuntu, that's my lazy web idea for the week. Someone make a custom Ubuntu, maybe with like the UI replaced by Croquet, and a Baby Smash program built in, and like a little parentally controlled video player, simple video player, and lightweight web browser, like a little kind of stripped down Firefox. It's all big friendly buttons and kind of very audio feedbacky kind of thing. I think that would be really hot. I think that would be like a totally awesome, and there are so many geek parents who would love to contribute to that distro. So that's my lazy web idea. Make it so. 10 days until we leave Los Angeles. First stop is Melbourne for the Melbourne Writers Festival. Actually, we're just stopping for a day, going up to Cairns, going scuba diving for a couple of days in the same boat that I was on when I got the idea for iRobot, a story that you heard podcast here before. Then back to Melbourne for the Melbourne Writers Festival. I'll be posting my schedule just before we go. And after Melbourne, we're going to Tokyo for a couple of days, all spoken for, all busy. Love to meet with you if you're in Tokyo, except I can't. And then we're going to Yokohama for the World Science Fiction Convention. I'll be posting my schedule for that too real soon now. And from there, off to do some travel in China. We're going to the World Economic Forum Young Global Leaders thing in Dalian, and then some tourism in Shanghai and Beijing. And then we go home to London on September the 17th, work our asses off for a week to get everything unpacked from the storage locker, go immediately to the picnic conference in Amsterdam, and then from there straight to Martha's Vineyard to teach the science fiction writing workshop I'll be teaching this year, Viable Paradise, and then back to London. Take a deep breath, settle in, and start getting an addition put onto the house so we'll have somewhere to put the baby in January. So that's my life for the next little while. You'll understand if I feel a little overwhelmed, but I'm going to do my best to get all of this stuff in the can and keep doing this podcasting while I'm at it. I'm getting a new kernel for my Ubuntu machine on Wednesday. I bought this Ubuntu machine from a great company called Emperor Linux that offers really kick-ass support. So they'll do things like, I'm having a problem with my USB. Oh, let me see if I can patch your kernel for you. When you have a minute, just call us up and let us know and execute this command on your keyboard that lets us remotely administer your machine, and we'll update your kernel for you and just reboot your computer when we're done, and it should all work. So with any luck, my USB headset will be working by Wednesday, and I'll be able to do podcasting from the road. If not, it'll have to wait until they have a working kernel for me that'll do the USB support for the headset, but then I'll pick up the podcast again. Right now, I actually took an old Mac out of mothballs to do this with, which is not my first choice for this. So, there we go. We are now ready to do the reading, and I just need to figure out where I was in my reading. There we go, where I was in my reading last week. And here is more of Bruce Sterling's Hacker Crackdown reading from part 2. Very little about the conditions of Goldstein's daily life would astonish, say, Václav Havel. We may note in passing that President Havel once had his word processor confiscated by the Czechoslovak police. Goldstein lives by Samizdat, acting semi-openly as a data center for the underground while challenging the powers that be to abide by their own stated rules, freedom of speech, and the First Amendment. Goldstein thoroughly looks and acts the part of Techno-Rat, with shoulder-length ringlets and a piratical black fisherman's cap set at a rakish angle. He often shows up at, like Banquo's ghost, at meetings of computer professionals where he listens quietly, half-smiling, and taking thorough notes. Computer professionals generally meet publicly and find it very difficult to rid themselves of Goldstein and his ilk without extra-legal and unconstitutional actions. Sympathizers, many of them quite respectable people with responsible jobs, admire Goldstein's attitude and surreptitiously pass him information. An unknown but presumably large population of Goldstein's 2,000-plus readership are telco security personnel and police who are forced to subscribe to 2600 to stay abreast of new developments in hacking. They thus find themselves paying this guy's rent while grinding their teeth in anguish, a situation that would have delighted Abby Hoffman, one of Goldstein's few idols. Goldstein is probably the best-known public representative of the Hacker Underground today, and certainly the best-hated. Police regard him as a Fagin, a corrupter of youth, and speak of him with untempered loathing. He is quite an accomplished gadfly. After the Martin Luther King Day crash of 1990, Goldstein, for instance, adeptly rubs salt in the wound in the pages of 2600. "Yeah, it was fun for the phone freaks as we watched the network crumble," he admitted cheerfully, "but it was also an ominous sign of what's to come. Some AT&T people, aided by well-meaning but ignorant media, were spreading the notion that many companies had the same software and that therefore could face the same problem someday. Wrong. This was entirely an AT&T software deficiency. Of course, other companies could face entirely different software problems, but then, so too could AT&T. After a technical discussion of the system's failings, the Long Island Technorat went on to offer thoughtful criticism to the gigantic multinationals' hundreds of professionally qualified engineers. "What we don't know is how a major force in communications like AT&T could be so sloppy. What happened to backups? Sure, computer systems go down all the time, but people making phone calls are not the same people logging onto computers. We must make that distinction. It is not acceptable for the phone system or any other essential service to go down. If we continue to trust technology without understanding it, we can look forward to many variations on this theme. AT&T owes its customers to be prepared to instantly switch to another network if something strange and unpredictable starts occurring. The nose here isn't so much the failure of a computer program, but the failure of AT&T's entire structure. The very idea of this person offering advice about AT&T's entire structure is more than some people can easily bear. How dare this near criminal dictate what is or isn't acceptable behavior from AT&T, especially when he's publishing, in the very same issue, detailed schematic diagrams for creating various switching network signaling tones unavailable to the public. See what happens when you drop a silver box tone or two down your local exchange or through different long-distance service carriers," advises 2600 contributor Mr. Upsetter in How to Build a Signal Box. "If you experiment systematically and keep good records, you will surely discover something interesting." This is, of course, the scientific method, generally regarded as a praiseworthy activity and one of the flowers of modern civilization. One can indeed learn a great deal with this sort of structured intellectual activity. Telco employees regard this mode of exploration as akin to flinging sticks of dynamite into their pond to see what lives on the bottom. 2600 has been published consistently since 1984. It has also run a bulletin board system, printed 2600 t-shirts, taken fax calls. The spring 1991 issue has an interesting announcement on page 45. "We just discovered an extra set of wires attached to our fax line and headed up the pole. They've since been clipped. Your faxes to us and anyone else could be monitored." In the worldview of 2600, this tiny band of technocrat brothers, and rarely sisters, are a besieged vanguard of the truly free and honest. The rest of the world is a maelstrom of corporate crime and high-level government corruption, occasionally tempered with well-meaning ignorance. To read a few issues in a row is to enter a nightmare akin to Solzhenitsyn's, somewhat tempered by the fact that 2600 is often extremely funny. Goldstein did not become a target of the hacker crackdown, though he protested loudly, eloquently, and publicly about it, and it added considerably to his fame. It was not that he is not regarded as dangerous, because he is so regarded. Goldstein has had brushes with the law in the past. In 1985, a 2600 bulletin board computer was seized by the FBI, and some software on it was formally declared a burglary tool in the form of a computer program. But Goldstein escaped direct repression in 1990 because his magazine is printed on paper and recognized as subject to constitutional freedom of the press protection. Here I'm going to insert a reader's note. This is Corey. Goldstein subsequently lost that protection in the 2600 case. This was the case over 2600 publishing the DCSS code for decrypting DVDs, when a court said that in the wake of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the First Amendment no longer applies to software and computer code that can be used to circumvent an anti-copying measure. This was a major blow to constitutional liberty. Back to the reading. As was seen in the Ramparts case, this is far from an absolute guarantee. Still, as a practical matter, shutting down 2600 by court order would create so much legal hassle that it was simply unfeasible, at least for the present. Throughout 1990, both Goldstein and his magazine were peevishly thriving. Instead, the crackdown of 1990 would concern itself with the computerized version of forbidden data. The crackdown itself, first and foremost, was about bulletin board systems. Bulletin board systems, most often known by the ugly and unpluralizable acronym BBS, are the lifeblood of the digital underground. Boards were also central to law enforcement's tactics and strategy in the hacker crackdown. A bulletin board system can be formally defined as a computer which serves as an information and message passing center for users dialing up over the phone lines through the use of modems. A modem, or modulator-demodulator, is a device which translates the digital impulses of computers into audible analog telephone signals, and vice versa. Modems connect computers to phones, and thus to each other. Large-scale mainframe computers have been connected since the 1960s, but personal computers, run by individuals out of their homes, were first networked in the late 1970s. The board, created by Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss in February 1978 in Chicago, Illinois, is generally regarded as the first personal computer bulletin board system worthy of the name. Boards run on many different systems, employing many different kinds of software. Early boards were crude and buggy, and their managers, known as systems operators, or sysops, were hardworking technical experts who wrote their own software. But like most everything else in the world of electronics, boards swiftly became faster, cheaper, better designed, and generally far more sophisticated throughout the 1980s. They also moved swiftly out of the hands of pioneers and into those of the general public. By 1985, there were something in the neighborhood of 4,000 boards in America. By 1990, it was calculated vaguely that there were about 30,000 boards in the U.S., with uncounted thousands overseas. Computer bulletin boards are unregulated enterprises. Running a board is a rough-and-ready, catch-as-catch-can proposition. Basically, anybody with a computer, modem, software, and a phone line can start a board. With second-hand equipment and public domain free software, the price of a board might be quite small, less than it would take to publish a magazine or even a decent pamphlet. Entrepreneurs eagerly sell bulletin board system software and will coach non-technical amateur sysops in its use. Boards are not presses. They are not magazines or libraries or phones or CB radios or traditional cork bulletin boards down at the local laundry, though they have some passing resemblance to those earlier media. Boards are a new medium. They may even be a large number of new media. Consider these unique characteristics. Boards are cheap, yet they can have a national or even global reach. Boards can be contacted from anywhere in the global telephone network at no cost to the person running the board. The caller pays the phone bill, and if the caller is local, the call is free. Boards do not involve an editorial elite addressing a mass audience. The sysop of the board is not the exclusive publisher or writer. He is managing an electronic salon where individuals can address the general public, play the part of the general public, and also exchange private mail with other individuals. And the conversation on boards, though fluid, rapid, and highly interactive, is not spoken, but written. It also remains relatively anonymous, sometimes completely so. And because boards are cheap and ubiquitous, regulations and licensing requirements would likely be practically enforceable. It would be almost easier to regulate, inspect, and license the content of private mail, probably more so since the mail system is operated by the federal government. Boards are run by individuals, independently, entirely at their own whim. For the sysop, the cost of operation is not the primary limiting factor. Once the investment in a computer and modem has been made, the only steady cost is the charge for maintaining a phone line or several phone lines. The primary units for sysops are time and energy. Boards require upkeep. New users are generally validated. They must be issued individual passwords and called at home by voice phone so that their identity can be verified. Obnoxious users, who exist in plenty, must be chided or purged. Proliferating messages must be deleted when they grow old, so that capacity of the system is not overwhelmed. And software programs, if such things are kept on the board, must be examined for possible computer viruses. If there is a financial charge to use the board, increasingly common, especially in larger and fancier systems, then accounts must be kept and users must be billed. And if the board crashes, a very common experience, then repairs must be made. Boards can be distinguished by the amount of effort spent in regulating them. First, we have the completely open board, whose sysop is off chugging brews and watching reruns, while his users generally degenerate over time into peevish anarchy and eventual silence. Second comes the supervised board, where the sysop breaks in every once in a while to tidy up, calm brawls, issue announcements, and rid the community of dolts and troublemakers. Third is the heavily supervised board, which sternly urges adult and responsible behavior and swiftly edits any message considered offensive, impertinent, illegal, or irrelevant. And last comes the completely edited electronic publication, which is presented to a silent audience which is not allowed to respond directly in any way. Boards can also be grouped by their degree of anonymity. There is the completely anonymous board, where everyone uses pseudonyms, handles, and even the sysop is unaware of the user's true identity. The sysop himself is likely pseudonymous on a board of this type. Second, and rather more common, is the board where the sysop knows, or thinks he knows, the true names and addresses of all users, but the users don't know one another's names and may not know his. Third is the board where everyone has to use real names, and role-playing and pseudonymous posturing are forbidden. Boards can be grouped by their immediacy. Chat lines are boards linking several users together over several different phone lines simultaneously so that people can exchange messages at the very moment that they type. Many large boards feature chat capabilities along with other services. Less immediate boards, perhaps with a single phone line, store messages serially, one at a time, and some boards are only open for business in daylight hours or on weekends, which greatly slows the response. A network of boards, such as FidoNet, can carry electronic mail from board to board, continent to continent, across huge distances, but at a relative snail's pace, so that a message can take several days to reach its target audience and elicit a reply. Boards can be grouped by their degree of community. Some boards emphasize the exchange of private, person-to-person electronic mail. Others emphasize public postings and may even purge people who lurk, merely reading posts but refusing to openly participate. Some boards are intimate and neighborly, others are frosty and highly technical. Some are little more than storage dumps for software, where users download and upload programs, but interact among themselves little, if at all. Boards can be grouped by their ease of access. Some boards are entirely public. Others are private and restricted only to personal friends of the sysop. Some boards divide users by status. On these boards, some users, especially beginners, strangers, or children, will be restricted to general topics, and perhaps forbidden to post. Favored users, though, are granted the ability to post as they please and to stay online as they like, even to the disadvantage of other people trying to call in. High-status users can be given access to hidden areas of the board, such as off-color topics, private discussions, and/or valuable software. Favored users may even become remote sysops, with the power to take remote control of the board through their own home computers. Quite often, remote sysops end up doing all the work and taking formal control of the enterprise, despite the fact that it's physically located in someone else's house. Sometimes several co-sysops share power. And boards can also be grouped by size. Massive nationwide commercial networks, such as CompuServe, Delphi, Genie, and Prodigy, are run on mainframe computers and are generally not considered boards, though they share many of their characteristics, such as electronic mail, discussion topics, libraries of software, and persistent and growing problems with civil liberties issues. Some private boards have as many as 30 phone lines and quite sophisticated hardware. And then there are tiny boards. Boards vary in popularity. Some boards are huge and crowded, where users must claw their way in against a constant busy signal. Others are huge and empty. There are few things sadder than a formerly flourishing board where no one posts any longer, and the dead conversations of vanished users lie about, gathering digital dust. Some boards are tiny and intimate, their telephone numbers intentionally kept confidential, so that only a small number can log on. And some boards are underground. Boards can be mysterious entities. The activities of their users can be hard to differentiate from conspiracy. Sometimes they are conspiracies. Boards have harbored, or been accused of harboring all manner of fringe groups, and have abetted, or been accused of abetting, every manner of frowned upon, sleazy, radical, and criminal activity. There are Satanist boards, Nazi boards, pornographic boards, pedophile boards, drug dealing boards, anarchist boards, communist boards, gay and lesbian boards. These exist in great profusion, many of them quite lively with well-established histories. Religious cult boards, evangelical boards, witchcraft boards, hippie boards, punk boards, skateboarder boards. Boards for UFO believers. There may well be boards for serial killers, airline terrorists, and professional assassins. There is simply no way to tell. Boards spring up, flourish, and disappear in large numbers in most every corner of the developed world. Even apparently innocuous public boards can, and sometimes do, harbor secret areas known only to a few. And even on the vast public commercial services, private mail is very private, and quite possibly criminal. Boards cover most every topic imaginable, and some that are hard to imagine. They cover a vast spectrum of social activity. However, all board users do have something in common, their possession of computers and phones. Naturally, computers and phones are primary topics of conversation on almost every board. And hackers and phone freaks, those utter devotees of computers and phones, live by boards. They swarm by boards. They are bred by boards. By the late 1980s, phone freak groups and hacker groups, united by boards, had proliferated fantastically. As evidence, here is a list of hacker groups compiled by the editors of FRAC on August 8, 1988. The Administration, Advanced Telecommunications Inc., Alias, American Tone Travelers, Anarchy Inc., Apple Mafia, The Association, Atlantic Pirate Guilds, Badass Motherfuckers, Bellcore, Bell Shock Force, Black Bag, Camera, CNN Productions, Catholics Anonymous, Chaos Computer Club, Chief Executive Officers, Circle of Death, Circle of Deneb, Club X, Coalition of High Tech Pirates, Coast to Coast, Corrupt Computing, Cult of the Dead Cow, Custom Relations, Damage Inc., D&B Communications, The Dange Gang, Deck Hunters, Digital Gang, DPAC, Eastern Alliance, the Elite Hackers Guild, Elite Freakers and Hackers Club, the Elite Society of America, EPG, Executives of Crime, Ecstasy Elite, Fargo 4A, Farmers of Doom, the Federation, Feds Are Us, First Class, 5-0, Five Star Force Hackers, the 414s, Hacker Trip, Hackers of America, High Mountain Hackers, High Society, the Hitchhikers, IBM Syndicate, the Ice Pirates, Imperial Warlords, Inner Circle 2, Insanity Inc., International Computer Underground Bandits, Justice League of America, Chaos Inc., Knights of Shadow, Knights of the Roundtable, League of Adepts, Legion of Doom, Legion of Hackers, Lords of Chaos, Lunatic Labs, Unlimited, Master Hackers, MAD, The Marauders, MD PhD, Metal Communications Inc., Metallabashers Inc., MBI, Metro Communications, Midwest Pirate Guilds, NASA Elite, the NATO Association, the Neon Knights, Nihilist Order, Order of the Rose, OSS, Pacific Pirates Guild, Phantom Access Association, Fido Freaks, The Firm, Flash, Phone Line Phantoms, Phone Freakers of America, Fortune 500, Freak Hack Delinquents, Freak Hack Destroyers, Freakers, Hackers, and Laundromat Employees Gang, The False Gang, Freaks Against Geeks, Freaks Against Freaks Against Geeks, Freaks and Hackers of America, Freaks Anonymous Worldwide, Project Genesis, The Punk Mafia, The Racketeers, Red Dawn Text Files, Roscoe Gang, Saber, Secret Circle of Pirates, The Secret Service, 707 Club, Shadow Brotherhood, Sharp, 65CO2 Elite, Spectral Force, Star League, Stowaways, Stratocrackers, Team Hackers 86, Team Hackers 87, Telecomputus Newsletter Staff, Tribunal of Knowledge, Triple Entente, Turnover and Die Syndrome, The Toads, 300 Club, 1200 Club, 2300 Club, 2600 Club, 2601 Club, 2AF, The United Softwares Force, United Technical Underground, Wear Brigade, The Warlords, and WASP. Contemplating this list is an impressive, almost humbling business. As a cultural artifact, the thing approaches poetry.